Stemmons Ferry Road. It was a balloon-frame building with thin walls and flowered grain sacks for curtains, but he was as yet unsure how much money he would make from his reading. Baths were 50 cents, an outrageous price, but he paid it and sat for 15 minutes in the hot water, and then shaved. He found the proprietor of the Broadway Playhouse sitting in the Bluebonnet Saloon, having an early drink, and engaged the small theater for the night. He wrote it down and had the man sign it, in case he got too drunk and forgot. He went on down Trinity to Thurber's News and Printing Establishment, where he was greeted and seduced by the smell of ink and the noise of the press coming from the rear. It was a Chandler and Price hand-fed patent press, slowly chunking out page after page of announcements or advertising. All around were sticks of type and the bindery equipment, the perforating machine. A sign on the wall. This is a printing office. Crossroads of civilization. Refuge of all the arts against the ravages of time. Armory of fearless truth against whispering rumor, incessant trumpet of trade. From this place words may fly abroad, not to perish on waves of sound, not to vary with the writer's hand, but fixed in time, having been verified in proof. Friend, you stand on sacred ground. This is a printing office. The captain took a deep breath to subdue the sudden bitter slash of envy, and then felt more or less all right. Thurber greeted him and inquired after his health, his readings, his journeys, and the Indian threat from the north. Did he not find traveling onerous? The captain fixed Thurber with his dark eyes and said no, he did not, and assured him that he, Jefferson Kyle Kidd, had not yet been forced to confine himself to a bath chair or an invalid's bed, and when he did, he would notify Thurber with a postcard. Thank you, sir, for your concern. The captain stalked around the print shop and gazed at the layout table and type cases. Thurber clasped his hands behind his back and rolled his eyes at his two printers' devils. Then the captain bought a sheet of letter paper and an envelope, and the latest editions of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Chicago Tribune, the London Times, the New York Herald, and El Clarion, a Mexico City newspaper. He would sit at peace in the hotel room under a proper roof and find articles of interest in the English language papers, and then translate some articles from El Clarion. Then he went down Trinity to the Dallas Weekly Courier offices, much refreshed from having snarled at Thurber, to sit with their Morse operator and take news from the AP wire. The fee was reasonable. The wire from Arkansas and points east was still operating. The Comanche and Kiowa had learned to cut the wire and then repair it with horsehair so that it would not transmit, but no one could tell where it had been cut. They well knew Army orders came over the telegraph wires. He took out the thick sheaf of printed notices and handbills from his portfolio and, there in the courier offices, inked in the last line. The latest news and articles from the major journals of the civilized world. Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd will read a compendium from selected newspapers at 8 p.m. at the Broadway Playhouse. He walked around the streets of Dallas, tacking up his notices as he went. These small towns in North Texas were always hungry for news and for a presenter to read it. It was so much more entertaining than sitting at home reading the papers, having only yourself or your spouse to whom you could make noises of outrage or astonishment. Then, of course, there were those who could not read at all, or only haltingly. He worried all up and down every street and with every tack he drove in, worried about the very long journey ahead, about his ability to keep the girl from harm. He thought resentfully, "I raised my girls. I already did that." At the age he had attained, with his lifespan short before him, he had begun to look upon the human world with the indifference of a condemned man. "Who cares for your fashions and your wars and your causes? I will shortly be gone, and I have seen many fashions come and go and many causes so passionately defended only to be forgotten." But now it was different, and he was drawn back into the stream of being, because there was once again a life in his hands. Things mattered. The strange depression and spiritual chill he had felt back in Wichita Falls was gone. But still he objected. He was an old man, a cranky old man. "I raised two of them already." A celestial voice said, "Well then, do it again." The captain had to admit that this was his own inner voice, which always sounded something like that of his father, the magistrate, who had often recalled to his son the law under the crown in colonial North Carolina, his voice speculative and gentle and lightly agreeable with drink. The cool spring wind skipped from roof to roof and dived down into the streets and flung women's hems up in rolling loops. The captain could see his breath. He pulled the tattered muffler close around his throat and shoved his good black hat down over his white hair. Texas weather was changeable as the moon. He bought barbecue and bread and a dish of sodden, unhappy-looking squash and carried it all back to the livery stable stacked in a tin pail.
"Captain!"
He heard her voice in a loud, happy cry. "Yes, Johanna," he said. Mrs. Gannett looked over the edge of a box stall with her bright hazel eyes and wide smile. He could just see the top of Johanna's head. Mrs. Gannett told him all was well, that the girl took some comfort in the horses, and that they were learning all their names. The captain found this a relief. His new-washed traveling trousers and two old shirts had been hung to dry over the wagon's dashboard, and his socks and unmentionables discreetly steamed, still hot from the tub, on the tie rods beneath. The girl's new second-hand clothing had been packed in the ammunition box. He opened the dinner pail on the lowered tailgate. Mrs. Gannett went back into her office. The captain watched her go. A strand of her dark brown hair had fallen from the confines of her bonnet, and her dress skirt moved very nicely without hoops. Then he turned to Johanna. "Dinner," he said carefully.
"Dinner."
The girl smiled and showed all her row of bottom teeth and gathered up her skirts to climb a wheel by the spokes into the wagon. He and Johanna sat on the side seats, and he watched as she took the camp butcher knife to cut off a great piece of the smoking barbecue meat, tossed it from hand to hand, crying, "Ah! Ah!" and when it was cool, tossed it expertly into her mouth. Barbecue sauce flew. The captain paused with his fork halfway to his mouth and watched her. She cut another piece and began tossing it. Her fingers were slick with fat, and there was red barbecue sauce up to her wrists. "Stop!" He put down his fork and wiped her hands with the napkins that had come with the dinner, and placed the fork in her hands. He grasped her small fingers, fork and all, in his bony and veined hand, and pushed the tines into the brisket and then lifted it to her mouth. She regarded him with that flat and vitreous stare that meant, he had learned, that she neither understood nor liked what she was seeing. She took the fork as one would grasp an ice pick and stabbed it into her dinner. She wrenched a piece loose and ate it from the tines. "No, my dear," he said. He put his hand over hers, once again placed the fork correctly, and once again lifted it to her mouth. Then he sat on his own side of the wagon and saw her struggling with the fork, the knife, the stupidity of it, the unknown reasons that human beings would approach food in this manner, reasons incomprehensible, inexplicable, for which they had no common language. She tried again and then turned and threw the fork into a box stall. The captain's shoulders dropped a fraction of an inch under his black formal coat. He was suddenly almost overwhelmed with pity for her. Torn from her parents, adopted by a strange culture, given new parents, then sold for a few blankets and some old silverware, now sent to stranger after stranger, crushed into peculiar clothing, surrounded by people of an unknown language and an unknown culture, only 10 years old, and now she could not even eat her food without having to use outlandish instruments. Finally, he took his satchel in one hand, tucked his portfolio under his arm, and beckoned to Johanna. He saw her look down at her stained hands, and there were tears on her cheeks. "We're going to try to get you into a hotel room," he said in a firm voice, "and you are going to have to stay there without breaking out the windows while I prepare my reading." He took hold of her greasy small hand and they started off down the street. 9. The captain went out and locked the hotel room door behind him. He stood in the hallway. He could hear her begin a Kiowa chant. This could mean anything. It could mean she was resigned. It could mean she was going to hang herself with the curtain cording, or set the place on fire, or go to sleep. At least she didn't have a weapon. At the desk, he laid down the key and said, "She was a Kiowa captive. I'm returning her."
"But, Captain, you'd think she'd be happy."
The young man at the desk had protuberant eyes, and in his hands was a false mustache. He was shaping it with a pair of nail scissors.
"You'd think she'd be skipping about and clapping her hands. That sounds like she is about to stab herself. It's operatic."
"I know," said the captain.
"Where is she going?"
"To near San Antonio."
"You mean you are putting up with that all the way to San Antonio? Perish and forbid."
"Young man, stop speaking in exclamation points. I have no idea what to do about it." The desk clerk breathed out long and carefully, with his eyes closed. He often played bit parts at the playhouse, usually a page or a messenger. He said, "Go get Mrs. Gannett to stay with her. We can't listen to this all night."
The captain saw that Mrs. Gannett had quite a lot of rich brown hair knotted in complex braids coiled all around her head. She had taken off her bonnet to beat it on a stall rail to knock the dust off.
She was instructing the stableman in a method of removing Chicago screws from a bridle.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he said, and turned and crossed one leg over another and fell down.
"Well, Billy be goddamn Bangtree," he said. "Legs, floor, unexpected."
His words were slurred.
"Peter," she said, "you are swearing. Get up."
"Things," he said, "under hay. Trip a person."
"Well, then pick them up," she said gently.
"Yes, Captain,"
she tried to smile. The captain stood formally with his hands crossed in front of him. He asked her to come and stay the night with Johanna, but did not, of course, mention the other reason, which was that it would be delightful, yes, enchanting, to think of her sleeping in the room next to his. He offered her a dollar to compensate.
"Captain, please," she said. "I am delighted to help."
That evening was the first time in the last week he could, he hoped, rest without cares, without tension and fear. Fear that the girl would run away and be lost and die of hunger, would try to swim the Red to get back to her Kiowa family. For the first 2 days he had wondered if she might attempt to kill him, or herself. Mrs. Gannett had come prepared to spend the entire night with her nightgown and other articles in a small brass-clasped thing that looked like a green fabric saddlebag. He opened the door to the room where Johanna sat on the floor cross-legged, rocking herself. Mrs. Gannett drew a light and delicate piece of divinity from her jacket pocket and held it out. Johanna fixed her blank stare on it. The captain saw her make the sign for poison. He said, "Eat half of it, Mrs. Gannett." She understood immediately, and bit half of the white candy, and said, "Mmm." Johanna reached up and took the other half from her in a glacially slow movement, and bit down on the taste of vanilla and sugar and egg white, felt the light crinkling of divinity shell in her mouth. She ate it unsmiling. The captain knew Mrs. Gannett had made it that afternoon, for Johanna. Divinity was very difficult to make. He backed out slowly and heard the lock click to. The walls of the hotel were made of cheap deal board, and he could hear everything from the room next door, and wished he could not. He sat down to outline his articles in ink, his pen nibs scratching across the rough newsprint with a noise like avaricious mice. He blew on the ink and then laid the newspapers aside and took up the letter paper to write to his daughters in Georgia. The room smelled of new raw lumber and the harsh soap they had used to wash the quilts and sheets. "My dearest daughters Olympia and Elizabeth," he wrote.
"Captain!"
Johanna banged on the wall. She was sobbing. He banged back.
"Johanna!" he said. My greetings and constant love to Emery and my grandchildren. I am well and continue to make my rounds with the news of the day, and as always am well received in the towns, of which we have more than a few now. As the century grows older, the population increases so that large crowds come to hear reportage of distant places as well as those nearby. I enjoy good health as always and hope that Emery is doing well using his left hand now, and look forward to an example of his handwriting. It is true what Elizabeth has said about employment for a one-armed man, but that concerns manual labor only, and at any rate, there should be some consideration for a man who has lost a limb in the war. As soon as he is adept with his left, I am sure he will consider typesetting, accounting, etc., and etc. Olympia is, I am sure, a steady rock to you all. Olympia's husband, Mason, had been killed at Adairsville during Johnston's retreat toward Atlanta. The man was too big to be a human being and too small to be a locomotive. He had been shot out of the tower of the Bardsley mansion, and when he fell 3 stories and struck the ground, he probably made a hole big enough to bury a hog in. The captain's younger daughter, Olympia, was in reality a woman who affected helplessness and refinement and had never been able to pull a turnip from the garden without weeping over the poor dear thing. She fluttered and gasped and incessantly tried to demonstrate how sensitive she was. Mason was a perfect foil, and then the Yankees went and killed him. Olympia was now living with Elizabeth and Emery in the remains of their farm in New Hope Church, Georgia, and was quite likely a heavyweight. He put one hand to his forehead. My youngest daughter is in reality a bore. There was a pounding on the wall.
Captain! Captain!
He got up and pounded back. Johanna, he said, go to sleep. The captain heard a soothing voice on the other side of the wall, the way one spoke to restless horses, firm, low-voiced, commands that were somehow gentle. Earlier he had heard Mrs. Gannett and the girl going down the hall to the bathroom, a small shriek of fear as the toilet flushed. You could hear everything in this hotel. He wished he had spent more money and had taken rooms in one of the big stone hotels where one's privacy was assured. Your husbands, having been both of old Georgia state regiments, would be true to their comrades, and so it was fate and the will of the Almighty had led you all to go back to Georgia to fight in the war, and thus into the heart of the burning. But considering what has occurred to other families, we return thanks for our dear ones who are still with us. I know travel is extremely difficult at present, but once you are here, things will be better. He paused, went back, and blotted it out from "and thus" to "burning" with a corner of torn paper, then struck through it, held the paper slantwise to the light, and saw that it was unreadable. Good. No dreadful memories or things that would induce weeping. The recent Houses of Senate and Representatives of the State of Texas have passed a law forbidding the population to carry sidearms, that is, handguns, but at present... He started to write about the Comanche and Kiowa raids across the Red River, but he saw that once again his news was falling into the alarming, the frightening, and he wanted his daughters and Emery and the children to come back to Texas. They had lived through enough. Their journey to Texas would be difficult, as most bridges in the South had been blown up or burned during the war, and the railroads and rolling stock shelled to pieces. There was no public money to rebuild. It was not only Sherman. It had been General Forrest who had blown up most of the railroads between Tennessee and Mississippi to keep the Yankees from using them. At any rate, they were all in tatters. Food and clothing were still scarce. They would have to apply for passes from the Union Army to travel the rutted and cratered roads, probably in 2 wagons with only 1 man for 2 women and 2 children, and that man with only 1 arm. They would have to cross the Mississippi at Vicksburg if there was a ferry. They would have to carry money to buy food and forage, while the roads were crawling with highwaymen. But at present we do well without sidearms, and there is no legal constriction against smoothbores, and so from time to time I enjoy a supper of quail and duck. The trumpeters and the whooping cranes are coming back and settle on the Red in their passage. Now, my dearest ones, enough gossip. I must come to the important part of my relations to you, which is that I consider you would all do well here in Texas rather than in the ruined and devastated states in the East. And please consider the land owing to your late mother. If you all were to return, I would be happy once again in the company of my daughters and son-in-law and my grandsons. And since Elizabeth has always been enamored of the process of law, she could begin the legal discovery and then turn it over to a lawyer adept at fixed asset litigation. Yes, I know the Spanish land has long been a chimera in our family, but indeed it is there and requires much research. If you would begin the process by writing to Señor Amistad de Lara, Land Commissioner and Archivist of the Spanish Colonial Historical Records, Bexar County Courthouse, and be sure to spell your mother's maiden name correctly, Señorita Maria Luisa Betancourt y Real, and the inherited land is Una Liga y un Labor, which means, and I hope you remember your Spanish, both grazing land and garden land, which was legally separated from the Mission Concepción, that is, Nuestra Señora de la Purísima Concepción de Acuña, spell it correctly and remember the accents, for Señor de Lara is a stickler. We have the Casa de Dueña in San Antonio still, as it has been continuously occupied by Betancourt descendants who are there now, aged as mummies and complaining because they cannot get white bread and must subsist on tortillas. Your mother's grandfather, Henri Hipólito Betancourt y Horas, bought the Lija and the Labor from the mission, but the laws of the Spanish crown said that all titles had to be registered in Mexico City, a journey of 2 months at least, so it was never registered there, and so there are problems with the clear title. Not to speak of the fact that after 1821 the land registration offices in Mexico City then fell under the Republic of Mexico, notoriously corrupt, and I have heard extremely careless with their filing systems. So a shaky title to these lands here came under the Republic of Texas, and then the United States, and then the Confederacy, and now the United States again. There are stacks of moldering papers in Señor de Lara's offices. You will love it, Elizabeth. You were born to be an ink-stained wretch, my dear. I believe the Labor is on the San Antonio River, 5 miles south of Concepción, and the Lija is on the Balcones Heights, amounting all told to more than 300 English acres. The Valenzuela family were running sheep and goats on it, but last I heard they had deserted the area.
"Captain!"
He heard a low sobbing. He bent his head to the paper. He thought Indians never cried. It pulled him away from these legal land questions. It tore his heart. He closed his eyes and laid down his pen and tried to calm himself. So much had fallen to the old since 700,000 young Southern men were casualties of war. Out of a population of a few million, he must arrange for his family to be together again. He must enter into litigation. He must make a living with his readings. He must deliver this child to her relatives, who would no doubt be utterly appalled by what she had become. For a moment he was completely at a loss as to why he had agreed to take her to Castroville. For Britt, a freed black man, that's why. In the next room, something broke. More quiet tones from Mrs. Gannett, the unflappable. No use trying to write any more. Your affectionate father, Jefferson Kyle Kidd. He heard the loud objections in Kiowa as the girl was dragged down the hall to the bathing facilities. One cannot think with a 10-year-old Kiowa German captive throwing soap and ceramics. After a while they came back and there was more sobbing. Then Mrs. Gannett began to sing. He bent his head and listened. She had a good voice, a clear, light soprano. She sang, "Jesus, keep me near the cross," and then, "It is well with my soul." He slowly shifted the letter paper and began to fold it. "When peace like a river attendeth my way." Very good. At age 71, he deserved peace like a river, but apparently he wasn't going to get it at present. The town of Dallas beyond the window raised up its new raw lumber buildings, and the air was woven with crashing wheel noises and shouts of the men at the ferry landing. What must the girl think of these man-made bluffs and rigidly straight byways? The sobbing died down. Mrs. Gannett sang Black is the Color. Not an easy song to sing unaccompanied. An old folk song in the Dorian mode. The girl was listening. It was much closer to the Indian way of singing. The unexpected turns and strange Celtic intervals. He wondered why he had not in the past year offered his attentions to Mrs. Gannett. And then he knew why. Because his daughters felt he should remain forever loyal to the memory of their mother. And if they found out about it, Olympia and Elizabeth would have had a galvanized tin hissy, one apiece. At last it was quiet on the other side of the deal board wall. He turned down the kerosene lamp. Nearly 8. Showtime. 10. A low traveling tide of gleaming white clouds told of more rain to come. There was good seating at the Broadway. That meant people were more comfortable and would therefore be patient and listen longer. The captain brought his own bull's-eye lantern, as always. He set it on a plant stand to his left, opposite to that of right-handed readers, and trained the light on the dense gray print. He laid down his small gold hunting watch at the top of the podium. At the front double doors, 2 U.S. Army men were stationed, as there were whenever there was a public meeting at any time. Texas was still under military rule. This might end in a few months if Washington would seat the Texas delegation. The recent election for Texas governor had not been between the old Southern Democrats and the Union-loyal Republicans. No, indeed. The old Southern Democratic Party was finished in Texas. The fighting was between 2 factions within the Republicans. The one led by Davis was extreme in its demand for dictatorial powers. The one led by Hamilton, not so much. Both were robbing the state blind. There was no point in appealing to one's congressmen to help clear up land titles in the state. They were too busy lining their pockets. Clearing the Betancourt land title would take up Elizabeth's time for years. She would enjoy it very much. There was a good crowd, and he heard the coins ringing into his paint can at the entrance. He greeted the crowd, as always, with a statement of thanks to the proprietor of the Broadway, a comment on the state of the roads from Wichita Falls to Spanish Fort, and then here. Then he shook out the London Times. It was in this way he asked people to enter another realm of the mind. Places far away and mysterious, brought to them by details which they did not understand, but which entranced them. He read of the attempt by the British colonial government to enumerate the peoples under their rule, a census, in short, and the rebellion of the Hindu tribes against the census takers because married women were not permitted to say aloud the names of their husbands. Nods. They are all beyond rational thought in those far countries. He read about a great windstorm in London that toppled chimney pots. What is a chimney pot? He could see it on their faces. And then of the new packing plants in Chicago, which would take any amount of cattle if they could only get them. In the crowd were men who were contemplating driving cattle all the way to Missouri if they could evade the savage tribes, and they listened with deep interest. The captain read of the Irish pouring into New York City, ragged crowds unloaded from the passenger steamer Aurora, of the railroad driving into the plains of the new state of Nebraska, of another eruption of Popocatépetl near Mexico City. Anything but Texas politics. Someone called, "Why are you not reading from Governor Davis's state journal?" The captain folded his newspapers. He said, "Sir, you know very well why." He leaned forward over the podium. His white hair shone, his gold-rimmed glasses winked in the bull's-eye lantern beam. He was the image of elderly wisdom and reason. "Because there would be a fist fight here within moments, if not shooting. Men have lost the ability to discuss any political event in Texas in a reasonable manner. There is no debate, only force. In point of fact, regard the soldiers beyond the door." He slapped his newspapers into the portfolio. He said, "I'm an aggregator of news from distant places, and as for the Austin paper and the Herald, you can read them for yourselves." The captain shut the flap on his portfolio and buckled it tight. "And fight among yourselves on your own time and not during my reading." He heard, "Hear, hear," from among the wet and shining heads of the men who held their hats in their hands, and from some of the women in their pancake hats and their bonnets. He blew out the bull's-eye lantern and took it and the portfolio and stepped down from the stage. Among the crowd filtering out, he saw, with a dropping feeling, the pale-haired man and the two caddos he had last seen in Wichita Falls and perhaps Spanish Fort. He knew the Indians were caddos because of their blunt-cut hair, sliced off just at the jawline, their shirts of a dark blue with a tiny print of yellow flowers. The caddos liked printed calico. The blond man sat relaxed in a theater chair with an ankle cocked up on the other leg and his hat on the point of his knee. He was watching the captain. As the captain stepped down from the lectern, people came to their feet. Some followed him. He shook the hands that were held out to him and accepted thanks and compliments. Everybody smelled like wet wool and camphor, and a sneezing small woman said, "Thank you, Captain," and shaking her hand gave him a moment's pleasure to see her bright cheeks. Perhaps he had taken her away from worry and preoccupation for a short while, what the captain called the hard thoughts. And a man with a grave look and a silver lapel badge in the shape of a shamrock from Hancock's 2nd Artillery Corps, Union. The captain shook his hand firmly. No matter what side you were on, if you had survived Gettysburg, you were to be congratulated. Perhaps he had briefly escorted the man's mind into the lands of the imagination. Far places, crisp ice mountains, falling chimney pots, tropical volcanoes. The manager of the Broadway came to him with the captain's share of the money. He had made nearly $20 in good U.S. silver. He wadded the sack of coins into his coat pocket. A man went around putting out the candles in the chandeliers with a long-handled snuffer. Inside the Broadway playhouse, it grew darker and darker.
"Captain," said the blond man.
He stood up.
"My name is Olme."
"And these are your friends," said Captain Kidd.
"They are."
The blond man put on his hat.
"You followed me from Wichita Falls. I think I saw you at Spanish Fort." "I have business here and there," said Olme. "How much do you want for the girl?"
Captain Kidd stopped stone cold. For a moment, a long moment, he stood expressionless and utterly still. "I was wrong. Somebody does want her." He put on his own hat. He settled it carefully on his white hair. He looked down at Olme, several inches shorter. He blinked once, slowly, as he buttoned up his black overcoat. He noted the two caddos directly behind him. Olme said,
"You know the army don't patrol the roads here like they do up on the Red. I could catch you on the road and just take her, you know. But I'm being a fair and straightforward man with you. How much?"
The captain said, "I hadn't settled on a price."
"Or found a buyer?"
"No, nor found a buyer."
"Well, let's consider it. I'm not close-fisted. I pay for what I want."
"Do you now?" Captain Kidd had left the .38 back in the hotel room. It was too big to pack around under the three-button frock coat he wore for readings, and it was heavy. Perhaps it was best. The feeling that was at present almost overwhelming him would have led him to draw and shoot the man on the spot. And then where would Johanna be when he was in jail?
"Yes? Tell me the name of anybody who says otherwise."
"I couldn't be bothered," said Captain Kidd. "Of course, I want assurances that the girl will be well treated."
"A bit better than what the Indians did to them," said Olme.
His lips flattened into a strange, stiff smile.
"At least she'll get paid for it. Blonde girls are premium, premium."
"Do tell." The captain nodded amiably. His mind was tearing ahead like a steam engine into the next hour, the next day. How much ammunition he had, if they knew where he was going, and if they did, if they knew what road he would take. He said, "I'll tell you what, Almay. Meet me tomorrow morning at the Tyler Stage Roadhouse at about 7. We'll work out a price. I did not take in much tonight, and I'm in need of funds."
"Good."
Almay's eyelids seemed heavy. He had gray eyes and the thick and colorless skin of people from Scandinavia or Russia. He seemed half asleep, or he was dreaming of some other world that was not this world, a place fragmented and without illumination. The captain touched his hat to the U.S. Army sergeant in blue at the door, something not many men would have done, and hurried out. The air was damp. Condensation sparkled on every surface and lay in a billion dots on the roof shingles. He saw Almay and the Caddos turn north up Trinity and in the opposite direction from his little hotel on Stemmons Ferry Road. He walked fast through the unpaved streets to Gannett's livery and called out to the oafish stableman, harnessed the roan mare and then backed her into the shafts, settled the collar, hooked up the trace chains, turned the wagon facing out. He changed clothes as fast as he had ever changed in his life. Into the wagon he threw his portfolio and the bag of coins, and wrapped up the remains of their supper in the frying pan. He put his formal black reading clothes and coat over his arm. He stroked Pasha's neck, wiped the fly specks out of his eyes, and then tied him on behind. He left the tin pail for the man to return to the cookshop. He said, "I'm going to get Mrs. Gannett. We will settle up in half an hour."
"Hour," said the stableman.
He sat up in his blankets where he had been sleeping in an empty stall with his handkerchief, for some reason, tied around his head, and an empty bottle clinked on the nail heads on the floor.
"Half? Damned hurry. People running around middle of night."
Then he fell back in the straw. The captain trotted down the dark streets of Dallas and then turned on Stemmons Ferry to the hotel. A few dim-lit windows here and there, and they seemed sinister and spying. He ran upstairs and went to his room and packed the carpet bag. He hefted it and went next door. He rapped hard and fast. Mrs. Gannett opened it in a nightgown that must have had 11 yards in the hem, her dark brown hair undone. He could smell the sulfur of a match. She had quickly lit their lamp. She wore a forest green wrapper over the nightgown, and her hair hung down her back and shoulders in shining plains. Her mouth was open. Behind her, Johanna sat up out of her bed, fully awake, and planted both her square feet on the floor. Mrs. Gannett was both calm and alert. "Captain," she said.
"Quick," he said. "We have to leave tonight."
Before he stepped up on the footplate, he removed his hat to Mrs. Gannett and expressed his thanks. She was outraged and shocked at what Almay had said. She did not know Almay, but she would know him now. Her eyes sparked in the light of the lantern she carried in one hand. She was furious. It gave her a bright and animated look, and he was felled on the instant. He took her hand. It was short and strong, and on her wrist was a bangle of silver and some sparkling red gems.
"I hope I may do myself the honor of calling on you on my return," said the captain.
He smiled. He was thinking of picnics on the banks of the Trinity.
"First return," she said, "and take care, my dear man."
He hesitated and then bent and kissed her lightly on the cheek. When they pulled out into the nighttime streets, she stood holding the lantern, and in its light, motes of hay sifted around her like fireflies. They set out down the Waxahachie Road to the south because Almay and his friends would expect them to take the Meridian Road southwest. Then, later in the night, they could cut west and get back on the Meridian Road. He hoped that when Almay and company saw no fresh tracks or sight of them on the Meridian Road, they would turn back and look for them elsewhere. Maybe he and Johanna could gain 3 or 4 hours on them. They trotted into the chain of hills that lay southeast of Dallas. They were called the Brownwood Hills. Before daylight, they should come to a country cut up by the Brazos River into ravines and sliding red rock cliffs, covered by live oak which had never been logged out. Some of them were as big around as millstones. He wanted to reach the river by daylight and pull off the road up high and watch for their pursuers. It would not take them long to bribe the stable hand for information. The man was a drinker. Drinkers were easy. The rain had cleared, and so they went at a good round trot. The sky was washed with clouds in one rainy line after another, and the moon at three-quarters full seemed to be rolling backward. The road before them was indistinct and without perspective. It was difficult to estimate distances in moonlight. The captain intended to put as many miles as possible between them and Almay and the Caddos before daylight. The captain was not averse to a fight, but he was poorly armed. He took out the revolver and stuck it in his waistband on the right side, butt forward. He needed a holster. The shotgun was 20-gauge bolt action, a single shot at a time, and all he had was birdshot. He had only one box of cartridges for the revolver. He thought there might be close to 20 rounds. There had been no money to buy another box or a holster when first they had come into Dallas, and now late at night the town was shuttered and closed, and those who were about were not people he wanted to meet. The shotgun lay at the captain's feet under the dashboard, long ways, loaded, the little lever on safety, and he worried about it. The lever was too easy to shift. It was loose. He could grab for it and fire off a shot right into one of the horses before he could bring it to bear if he were not careful. It was March 5th and cold. His breath fumed and his old muffler was dank with the steam. Above and behind them, the Dipper turned on its great handle as if to pour night itself out into the dreaming continent, and each of its seven stars gleamed from between the fitful passing clouds. After several hours, he found a track going west and took it, and within 2 hours they were on the Meridian Road. The country here was sparsely settled and only occasionally policed. Indian raids out of the north were a given. They pressed on. The girl sat in the wagon bed behind, wrapped in the thick red and black horongo. There was no method by which he could explain anything to her, but she did not need explanations. Her family and her tribe had fought with the Utes, their ancient enemies, and the Caddos. They had conducted a long guerrilla warfare with Texas settlers and Texas Rangers, and then with the U.S. Army. Often enough they had faced the howling, striving demons of the open plains. Hunger, tornadoes, scarlet fever. She didn't need to be told anything except that there were enemies in pursuit, and she had already figured that out. The road was open before them, a two-track stretch in the pale of the moon, rolling over the lifts and falls of the prairie country of central Texas. They passed a farmhouse set back among trees. The farm buildings appeared to be great dozing animals that had gathered near the house in the night. There was a light shining in a window. Somebody was waiting up for somebody. Pasha tested the air for the scent of a mare. Had there been one, he would have called out, making promises he would never be able to fulfill, but since all he could smell was a donkey and another gelding, he held his peace and trotted on. Here and there were copses of post oak holding up wiry armatures of limb and twig, rattling with old brown leaves, and in the cold night air a hissing, swift shape passed in front of them. The girl cried out, "Saupoldul!" She bent herself forward and carried the red wool up around her nose as if she would not breathe the air. Saupoldle brought news of a death. Soon, here. It cut the air like a blade and trailed plump legs like a child's in fluffy pantaloons. "Great horned," said the captain. "Ignore it, Johanna. Pretend it was a nighthawk." 11. At first light, the captain and Johanna were only a mile or so from the Brazos. As they went on, they came to the little road that ran alongside the north bank. Then they came to a place he remembered as Carlisle Springs. The spring fed down out of a bluff of red sandstone into a ravine and then into the Brazos itself. It sparkled all the way down, jumping in transparent streams from pool to pool. The captain looked up and thought he saw a way to get up there, a faint wagon track zigzagging up the slope. He turned fancy off the road and went uphill. After 100 yards, he had to get down and lead the mare through agarita and spiky young live oaks that tore at the underside, but all he could think of was, "Get under cover, get under cover." He felt like he was pulling the load of the world behind him. Fancy, and the girl jolting around in the driver's seat, and Pasha scrambling behind. Everything was dripping wet and bedewed, and soon he was soaked to the knees. At the top, he found the only flat place to stop. There were trees and thickets of sumac to give them some concealment. Some stumps. Somebody had been up here cutting fence posts. From a layered stack of red sandstone, crenellated and thick as a barbican, he could see the road below. He bent over with his hands on his knees to relieve his back muscles. He was stiff from the long night's drive. Everything hurt. He straightened up and turned to her with the wrapped bacon in his hand. She took it from him, dropped the tailgate, and laid it down. "I cook." She smiled up at him. Then she held out a piece of divinity candy. "Good horse lady," she said. "Eat, Captain." Her little face was round as an apple. He returned the smile. "Yes, very good," he said. He ate the piece of divinity, and the sugar hit his bloodstream in a rush. He took off his hat and ran his fingers through his white hair. His coat hung open to the morning wind. He felt in his pockets for his pipe. The girl collected dry wood in her skirt as if happy to discover that skirts were good for something after all. He handed her the match safe, and she started the fire in the little cook stove. With the butcher knife, she expertly carved the bacon. She sang to herself. This was life as she knew it, and it was good. No roofs, no streets. Her new washed taffy hair flew in loose ribbons in the morning breeze. Every so often she lifted her head to run her gaze over the live oaks around them and listen for an enemy presence. Then she went back to slinging rashers into the skillet. The captain stuffed tobacco into his kaolin pipe. And here he was in his mild and mindless way, still roaming, still reading out the news of the world in the hope that it would do some good. But in the end he must carry a weapon in his belt, and he had a child to protect, and no printed story or tale would alter that. He considered the men who must be following them, and also that the smell of tobacco smoke carried far and wide, far more than meat smoke, so on second thought he laid down the pipe. He unharnessed Fancy and tied her beside Pasha and rubbed them both down with a rice straw brush. If the captain and Johanna had to run for it, they would do better on horseback than in the wagon. He paused over the saddle and blankets. Not yet. But he found Pasha's riding bridle in the heap of tack and laid it over a wheel where it would be ready to hand. He pulled on his riding boots with the undershot heels and then his spurs, and shoved in the toggles to fix them and keep them from ringing. From his pockets he took out his gold watch and some pennies and his penknife and laid them on the tailgate. He wanted nothing about him that would clink, make a noise. He took out the revolver and once again made sure every chamber was full. He put it back into his waistband. The 8-inch barrel made it feel like he was carrying an axe handle. White-winged doves sat up in the oaks and shifted from one pink foot to another and bobbed and sang because they wanted to come to water at the spring but were afraid. The captain wished he could go back down to the road to see how much of the wagon was visible from there. He guessed probably the top boards. He did not know how soon Alme and his friends might have started from Dallas after them. Probably at about 7:30, 8 in the morning, when he did not show up at the Tyler Stage Roadhouse. When they saw no tracks on the Meridian Road, he hoped they would have doubled back to the Waxahachie Road and stayed on it. With luck, they would be far away to the east, bumbling along and crying out, "Where did they go? Where did they go?" But they would wise up soon enough, and they were on horseback and therefore faster. He did not go down. They might catch him down there on foot with a long climb back up to the wagon among the rocks. He lay on his stomach and watched the road. It was red dirt, two tracks with a strip of mullein and Indian grass in the middle. He could see two sections through the trees, one about a half mile away and another piece just below. He wiped at his tired eyes and then took up his guard duty again. In the increasing light of day, the captain thought he saw the moving and reflective slash of a horse's tail. The doves became silent. "Hmm," he said. He climbed up to the wagon seat for a better view. It was perhaps 50 degrees. A thin, watery sun laid its gunmetal shine on the country below. The hills were ridges widely separated from one another in great tree-covered waves, as if they were drifting apart from one another across the stone underpinnings of the earth. On the horizon of cedar-covered hills, a thick billowing of smoke rose into the sky. Somebody was burning slash or stubble about 3 or 4 miles away. The little stove erupted in a singing clatter of broken pipe and scattered coals. The hurtling skillet lid sailed away over a wave of flying hot grease. Another ear-splitting bang. Bacon and coffee spun into the air. The girl was under the wagon in less than a second. The captain fell sideways off the seat. He landed on his left side. It was quicker and safer than standing up to climb down. He scrambled under the wagon. Another round hit the sideboards above him and splinters sprayed into the air. He thought of the flour keg with the .38 ammunition in it. They won't want to kill the horses, and they won't want to take a chance on killing the girl. He lifted himself on his elbows and made a reassuring gesture. She was flat on her stomach, and her face was turned sideways to him, keeping her eyes on his square old hawk's face. They were lying among rocks and small spiny agarita. A lizard fled in a running of dark chevrons. They're firing up from the ravine. They have rifles. The captain crawled from under the wagon to the edge of the caprock and found a notch in it. He pulled out the revolver. Another shot from the right, different place. They had both been from the right. So where was the third man? He spat on his hand, then smeared it on his revolver barrel, and then sifted dust over it. The Smith & Wesson with its long barrel was accurate, but nowhere near as accurate as a rifle, and it didn't have the range. Their rifles were good for 200 yards or more. They could stay out of range and blast away at him till the cows came home. The shotgun was good only for close work. He had only 15 shells of light number 7, what they called turkey shot or dove shot, which would at most pepper somebody's face with a permanent tattoo unless you jammed it right up against them at face-to-face range. That was a situation he would not be likely to survive. In the shot box were powder and caps and hulls to make up more shotgun shells, as if it mattered. He lay still and felt running tremors in his belly. Fear for himself, for the girl. Help me. He turned and saw Johanna crawling toward him, dragging the box of .38 ammunition. She had got it out of the flour keg. It was covered with flour. So were her hands. He took the box and then pointed sternly to the wagon. She wriggled back. This was not the first time that someone had wanted to kill him, but the other times had been what one might call fair fights. The 2 rifle shots sounded to the captain as if they had come from Henry's. A Spencer made a flatter barking sound, but it could have been the gunpowder they were using. He smelled the gunpowder smoke rising up from below in long windless strands that snarled in the cedar. His mouth was dry. They had been traveling the entire night, and he was weary, and the cloudy light was diffuse, so it was difficult to see. He had not thought they would turn so quickly to murder. He had thought if they caught up, they would bluster, threaten, offer a certain amount in silver, perhaps even claim they were the girl's relatives. He saw himself pointing the long barrel of the Smith & Wesson into their faces and saying something like, "Begone, or I will blow you through." This was clearly not going to happen. Human aggression and depravity still managed to astonish him. He had been caught by surprise. The girl was under the wagon. She was listening. Then she lifted her hands and whipped her long hair into a braid and tied it off with a piece of lace edging she tore from her skirt. She was not astonished. Not at all. He lay still in the crumbled stone and blue-green agarita behind the protection of the caprock. He waited. He and Johanna were exposed to the wooded slope behind them, higher ground, but it was a good quarter mile away. Alme and the caddos were coming up from below. The wagon must have been just barely exposed. He waited. The wind was cold. He heard, remotely, the lever action of another Henry, and then saw another puff of gunpowder smoke below, from behind a long slanting buttress of red stone on the right side of the ravine. Instantly afterward, he heard a sharp, flat crack, and the noise of the wagon being hit again. Splinters burst into the air and rained around him. Pasha fell back on his halter rope, but it did not break, so he came up straight again. He wasn't hit. Fancy was more determined, and tore her halter rope loose and went crashing away into the trees and stopped. She was hung up on something. The captain waited for the other, or two others, if they were all armed with rifles. He had to hoard his revolver ammunition and watch for the best shot, even if they were right in his face. It seemed his eyes would start from his head. He had to shut them for a moment. Then a 45 long Colt round struck to his right like a hammerhead, about 6 feet away, and then he heard the muzzle blast. He didn't turn his head, but only noted where the smoke came from. It had also come from the right side of the ravine, farther down. Number three. The shot did not have that deep, biting bark of a rifle, so it was a revolver. They had all three come up single file on one side. Stupid. They were overconfident. They were up against nothing but an old man and a girl. In some ways he wouldn't mind going out in a blaze of glory. 71 was a good long time to have lived. But then there was Johanna. The mild, watery sun of early March poured down a shadowless light. Not many reflections. Another shot. It chipped the face of the dark, dense limestone to his left. He did not duck nor glance in that direction, but watched for the smoke. He saw it. Same rifle. Two. That's all they had. The third man was the odd man out and had to make do with a revolver, like himself. Then he saw a man jump from one buttress of rusty red stone to another to cross the ravine to the other side. He was carrying a rifle. The captain fired three times, chipping the stone around the man, sending up sprays of cedar duff and the sumac leaves like little airborne ears. It was one of the caddos. They were trying to nail him between two lines of fire, a rifle to his left and a rifle and a handgun to his right. A brief glimpse. The caddo was wearing a heavy leather glove on his left hand. So he was right, they did have Henrys. There was no floor arm on the Henry, and its hot barrel and the magazine tube had to be handled with a glove. Another shot. He waited for the flash of a rifle barrel on his left, within the range of his revolver, saw it, fired twice, and heard a yell, and the rifle flew away and got wedged among the rocks. Got him. At least he had knocked the rifle out of his hand. And now the stupid fool was going to go after it. He aimed and waited. He was sure the caddo was going to try to retrieve his precious, expensive rifle. Go for it, man. Over on the other side of the ravine, he caught a glimpse of the crown of a hat. He was too smart for that. It was on a stick. Johanna, get back. The girl ignored him. She was edging along the caprock to his right. She ducked in and out between the great tabular sections of red sandstone, holding on to the unforgiving rock with her bare hands. She peered over, she ducked back. She carried the stove lid lifter in one hand, and now she began to lever at the base of a flat layer of stone. She had pulled the back hem of her skirts between her legs and tucked it into the dainty belt at her waist in front so it looked as if she were wearing big Turkish pantaloons. She was still barefoot. She looked like the engravings he had seen of Circassian children in their rags and bandoliers fighting the Russian troops somewhere in the Pontus. This was clearly not her first gunfight.
"Mal sape," she said. "Caddos. The ring-in-the-nose people. They will die."
She didn't care if he did not understand her. It was simply important to say, "They will die." The captain turned back to his notch, and through the leaves on the left he saw the caddo's black hair glinting as he dodged from rock to rock, down the ravine, going for his rifle. He fired again. A yell, then whimpering. One wounded. How bad, he didn't know. Sweat ran from under his hat, from the tattered sweatband, and into his eyes, and he wiped his eyes on his shoulder one after the other, quickly. He was surprised when he saw he had to reload. He had not thought he had fired so many rounds. His hands had flour on them from the box of shells. Johanna was still levering at the base of a slab of stone with the lifter. To his amazement, she tipped it up, and then over, and it rolled end over end like a flat plate on edge, leaping downhill, smashed in half on an outthrust boulder, and then shattered and fell in pieces upon somebody. There was a deep shout, almost a grunt, and the man fell forward out of concealment and rolled.
"Good girl," he said. "Demon child."
He laughed as he fired again and again, careless of the expenditure of ammunition.